This episode is brought to you by Vonage. With Vonage Video API, your developers can easily create custom video experiences tailored to your business. Enhance every conversation with live video, whether it's delivering faster tech support, improving customer service, or enabling interactive meetings and events. Unlock the true video potential of your business. Discover how at Vonage.com.
Last week, Wall Street Journal reporters Sean Lee and Stephanie Yang were traveling to Wuhan, the city at the center of China's coronavirus outbreak. On the way, they stopped for the night in a hotel in a city called Shenyang. It was supposed to be a quick stop, just a place to get a good night's sleep before hiring a car to take them the rest of the way. But that's not how things turned out.
This is now day 10 of the quarantine.
When we talked to Sean and Stephanie earlier this week, they were still at that hotel in Shenyang, under official quarantine.
So tell me about this hotel where you're being held. What does it look like?
It's very nicely decorated. It has sort of cream and gold floral wallpaper. It's a kind of a pleasant business hotel.
So you're not too uncomfortable then?
No, it's actually very nice. I think what I realized after 10 days is physically we're really comfortable, but it's just you get a sense of sort of sensory deprivation that you don't realize. We've seen and smelled the same things for the last 10 days. You know, we haven't felt the wind, and we just have each other for company.
Sean and Stephanie had been on their way to cover the coronavirus. Now they found themselves living another story about surveillance and state control. It's a story that's unfolding across China right now.
Today on the show, life under quarantine and under surveillance in China's coronavirus outbreak. Welcome to The Journal, our show about money, business, and power. I'm Kate Limbaugh.
And I'm Ryan Knudsen. It's Friday, February 7th. When we last heard from Sean on the show, she had just left Wuhan, the city where China's outbreak started. The government had imposed a travel ban around the city, and she caught one of the last trains out. But once Sean made it to Beijing and was able to stock up on protective masks and gear, she wanted to go back to keep reporting on the outbreak. So she and Stephanie started traveling back in the direction of Wuhan. The city of Shenyang was supposed to be just a stop along the way. But the night they checked into their hotel, that plan started to go sideways.
We get a call at night around 11:30 p.m. from the hotel lobby, and they said, "This man from the local foreign affairs office wants to see you downstairs."
Sean and Stephanie had pinged the radar of the Chinese state.
So we went down. We met Mr. Wang in person. He's kind of this mild-mannered man, and he was wearing a face mask. And as soon as we saw him, he put his hands up and he said, "Under the circumstances, you'll forgive me for not shaking your hand." So we sat down with him, and he was quite nice. He basically just said, "Look, you just arrived, but I just wanted to tell you the situation."
Mr. Wang said the coronavirus was spreading in Hubei province. Travel could be shut down in Shenyang at any time. And then Sean and Stephanie might not be able to leave the city. It would be better for everyone, he said, if they got out of Shenyang immediately. The women with the foreign passports and journalist visas should go that night.
The kind of tone was, "You should leave while you still can, because you might not be able to." You know, we just said, "Thank you for your concern. We'll just think that over."
Sean and Stephanie weren't ready to leave. They were still hoping to get back to Wuhan to report on one of the biggest stories in the world right now. But Mr. Wang turned out to be right. They would get stuck in Shenyang. As the virus spread, concern grew about travelers transmitting the virus. Sean was told that officials in Shenyang were putting all the hotels in the city under quarantine. Sean and Stephanie wouldn't be able to leave the hotel for 14 days. So what does quarantine look like?
They have anywhere between 2 to 4 guards in the hotel lobby guarding the entry and exit at all times. Everyone in the hotel is under quarantine, all the guests. And there's about 15 to 20 other people, I think, just approximately staying at this hotel.
And how have you guys been spending your time over the last 10 days in this hotel?
Mostly working, to be honest, because, you know, we have nothing else to do. We watched Steph introduce me to the quarantine episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
This is the worst flu that Philly has ever seen.
Wow.
We have to quarantine ourselves.
What? Frank.
The sort of dad figure is convinced that they're going to catch this flu or cold that's going around Philly. So he convinces everyone to quarantine in the bar that they run.
Another feature of life in quarantine, temperature checks. Sean and Stephanie were being dropped in on regularly by a rotating cast of masked visitors.
We've been getting knocks at the door for temperature checks from, they describe it as the local virus control committee.
Sean still isn't exactly sure who the members of the virus control committee are. They wouldn't answer her questions. But they showed up at her hotel room a few times a day with the temperature guns that have become ubiquitous in China.
They come, they say about every 4 hours, sometimes it's every 3 hours. One day it was every 90 minutes. They press it against your forehead or your neck. No one seems to really know how to use them. And then they just note down your temperature.
Everything that Sean was experiencing, the temperature checks, the visits from local officials, the guards, it was all just a tiny piece of the giant state apparatus that China has mobilized to combat its worst public health crisis in decades. One of our Asia editors, Patrick Barda, has been watching that effort unfold.
Everything that we're seeing right now is consistent with the way China has tended to go after crisis situations. It approaches them with a very strong central authority, a guiding state hand, almost military-like, a campaign-like approach to solving problems.
Solving the problem of an outbreak often involves figuring out who's sick, where they've been, and who they've interacted with. That way you can track and treat others who might have been exposed. And in China's campaign to do that, it's using a unique tool— one that many other countries either don't have or have been reluctant to use, a sprawling high-tech surveillance system they've built up over decades.
Well, so the Chinese government knows people's activities, it knows their movements, it knows potentially their conversations, and there are a lot of reasons for that. And one of them is that you have to submit your ID number for a lot of things, like buying train tickets, bus tickets, even if you're just going, you know, to the next town over, they'll know where you're going.
The fact that you're constantly showing ID in China, that's how Sean thinks Mr. Wang knew about her and Stephanie. Because after you check into a hotel in China, the hotel passes that ID information along to local authorities. But it's not just ID. In China, the government has a direct line to its citizens through social media, too.
In China, the very popular social messaging app is WeChat, and people use it for everything. And you talk with your friends with it, you get lunch delivered, you pay your utility bills, you book travel. And because of Chinese law, the company that owns WeChat is forced to hand over data from that service whenever the government or the police requests it. No warrants, you know, they just hand it over. So you know whenever you use something, there's just an assumption in China that the state can access it.
And then there's the high-tech, futuristic stuff that China has been installing faster than any other country, like facial recognition technology.
You run into facial recognition in ways in China that you don't everywhere else. It's increasingly used at airports, train stations, to get into office buildings, sometimes, you know, ATMs. There are even public toilets that'll use facial scanners to limit the amount of toilet paper you can take.
You're kidding. Wait, facial recognition to limit the amount of toilet paper you use?
Well, you just wouldn't want people taking too much toilet paper.
So how is China using all of its data in this crisis?
Well, you know, there's a case of the city of Nanjing where they were able to identify a person that they believed was infected with the virus, and then they were able to track that person all over the place. This is someone who was not quarantined, was not in a hospital. So their technologies enabled them to track that person getting on a bus surrounded by tons of people, getting on a subway, going in and out of buildings. The person went to, I think, a couple of hospitals. The kicker is that they published the details on social media so that people in those areas could see that and say, oh, well, I might have been in the vicinity of an infected person. I need to go get checked.
Some of China's largest companies, including railway and telecom companies, are helping the government track people's movements during the outbreak. A Chinese internet company even released a map that allows users to see the final destination of cars leaving Wuhan. But the high-tech approach to surveillance has its limits.
Facial recognition requires a face to look at, to identify you. If you're wearing a mask, as the vast, vast majority of people are now, that mask obscures part of your face, so it becomes very difficult to identify you.
As a result, China has been falling back on other methods, methods that rely not on tech, but on people. And China's history with this kind of surveillance goes back decades.
It goes back to the Mao era. You know, in those days, it wasn't high tech. It was the government gathering files on people, keeping records of everything they do, their failures, their accomplishments. You know, all that was used to help determine, you know, things like the job you got or where you got to live. And then, you know, over the years, you saw the expansion of the sort of neighborhood watch or what they called grid management systems, where communities are divided up into certain numbers of households, and you had captains or managers who would keep track of things.
Remember those visitors at Sean's hotel door who said they were from the local virus committee? They may have been from one of these neighborhood watch groups, checking in and reporting things up the chain. But Sean was beginning to suspect that there was an even more intense level of surveillance going on at her hotel. She'd noticed something strange about the hotel guest across the hall. That's coming up.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. If you're like most people, you've had your fair share of financial questions. Questions like, will you be able to afford a third kid? Will you be able to do everything you want when you retire? What if you outlive your savings? Empower knows these questions can be stressful, so they're here to help answer your what-ifs and empower what's next. Join 18 million Americans and take control of your financial future. Tap the banner to learn more or visit empower.com.
This episode is brought to you by GlobalX ETFs. Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the GlobalX Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing carefully, consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Company.
Welcome back. Early in their stay at the hotel in Shenyang, Sean and Stephanie noticed something strange about their across-the-hall neighbor.
His door was propped ajar with a deadbolt the entire time, and it was the only door in the hallway like that, which is just kind of unusual.
His door was always cracked open, just a little bit. That was the first weird thing.
And two, we went downstairs a couple of times that night, once to pay for another night, and a second time to ask about room service. And both times, he followed us downstairs. Not immediately, right? But as soon as we came down to the lobby, about a minute or two later, he followed. And it was the same guy, kind of a youngish guy, maybe late 20s, early 30s, wearing a face mask.
Sean was sure the man was monitoring them. But to test it, she took a middle-of-the-night trip down to the hotel lobby to see if the man would follow.
So I went downstairs at 3 a.m., and it took him a few minutes longer than the previous two times to follow, but he kind of stumbled into the lobby a few minutes later. I mean, it was clearly him. He was wearing a face mask and yellow and black pajamas. That's when I knew we were being monitored and surveilled.
It's hard to tell just how much of Sean's experience is due to her being a foreigner and a journalist, but elements of what's been happening to Sean are happening across China. tens of millions of people are under lockdown. In some cities, officials are limiting how many times per week people can leave their homes. In one city, only one person per household is allowed to leave every 5 days. And the Chinese government has pulled regular people into their enforcement efforts, too. They're offering cash rewards for reporting neighbors who have a fever or cough. In at least one city, officials dangled face masks, which have become scarce, as a reward for reporting people who traveled to Wuhan and didn't disclose it. As the number of sick people has ticked up to more than 30,000, Sean says there's a real sense of fear. She's felt it from everyone at the hotel. The staff became convinced that Sean and Stephanie had the virus. They'd registered temperatures that the hotel staff thought were too high.
That was when they said, you can't leave your rooms. You're not allowed to roam around the hotel anymore. You're confined to your rooms. And if you don't follow that, we're going to take you to the hospital.
After that, the staff's behavior toward them totally changed.
You could tell that the hotel staff that had to deliver our room service to the door were just very, very nervous. They no longer brought the food into the room. They put it on a cart and kind of gingerly pushed it into the room. They started all wearing plastic gloves. And at one time, one of them knocked on the door. And before I answered it, she called through the doorway, are you wearing a face mask? You know, I said, yes. And then when she was pushing the cart in, she whispers under her breath, what's your temperature?
Sean felt fine and hasn't shown any symptoms. And it appears that high temperature reading was probably just a mistake. But all of this has made her eager to leave. And then, a few days ago, she was on a call with Mr. Wong, the official who dropped by that first night at the hotel. He'd been calling Sean and Stephanie regularly to check in.
I mentioned sort of as an aside, oh, you know, once the quarantine is over, I'm going to be so glad to sort of be able to walk outside and just kind of wander because from our window, Shaoyang actually looks like quite a nice city. And he said, no, you won't be allowed to leave the hotel after your quarantine. You'll be allowed to leave your rooms, but not the hotel. And I just thought, back up a second. What?
So he's telling you this quarantine can be indefinite? How did you feel when you heard that?
Honestly, my heart sank.
Mr. Wong explained that it was nothing personal. They were discouraging everyone in Shenyang from going outside.
He said, you know, it's not you guys. We're not trying to restrict your freedom. This is for the good of the country.
For the good of the country.
For good of the society and for the country.
Patrick, how long do you think people will put up with it? How are people feeling about all this surveillance?
Well, at the moment, China is right in the, you know, the teeth of a very frightening disease. And there's definitely a lot of criticism of the government's handling of this crisis. But I do think that on a wide level right now in China, a lot of people are, for lack of a better word, reassured that their government is taking the threat seriously and using tough measures. And again, that's certainly not everybody. I'm sure a lot of people are quite resentful. And I think that's the thing to watch, because if this continues for weeks and months and these quite draconian measures are not successful, that resentment will become a serious, serious problem. People quarantine, people under observation, people, you know, ratting out each other. You can do that for a while when people are deeply, you know, worried, bordering on panic about a situation. But you can't sustain that for weeks and months at a time. You know, that's one reason why this government's got to get this thing under control as quickly as possible before it actually starts to generate serious questioning of what they're doing.
When we ended our call with Sean earlier this week, she and Stephanie were prepared for a long stay at the hotel. But as this episode was getting ready to publish, they sent us an update. Sean and Stephanie had made it out of quarantine and out of the country on a U.S. State Department evacuation flight. After 12 days in quarantine in Shenyang, Sean and Stephanie were out. That's all for today, Friday, February 7th.
The Journal is a co-production of Gimlet and The Wall Street Journal. Your hosts are me, Kate Linebaugh.
And me, Ryan Knutson. Special thanks to Stephanie Yang, Jim Arity, and Lisa Lin for their reporting.
We're produced by Annie Minoff, Ricky Novetsky, Sarah Platt, Willa Rubin, and Rob Zipko. Our senior producer is Pia Gadkari.
Annie Rose Strasser is our supervising producer. Griffin Tanner is our engineer. Our executive producer is Gerard Cole.
Our theme music is by So Wiley. Additional music from Bobby Lord, Peter Leonard, So Wiley, and Blue Dot Sessions.
Special thanks to Catherine Anderson for additional mixing.
Thanks for listening.
See you Monday.